everybody, and welcome to the Weekly Wind Down. I am Jackie D, the literary lesbian.
I'm Jean, the feisty feminist.
I'm Erin, the geeky gal pal.
And I'm Nicole Disney. I'm the guest for the evening.
Welcome, Nicole.
Welcome, Nicole. Disney.
Before we started recording, we were discussing whether or not Nicole would be zacked tonight. So we'll see if that happens.
I'm all prepared.
I'm not even going to explain what that means. I'll let people wonder.
And you know what? They're guaranteed to find out what it is by the end of the episode anyway. So
let well, I have high suspense. Expectations now.
So. Do you ever watch Big Brother?
Much pressure.
Do you watch Big Brother, Erin?
No.
Okay, so there's this robot that comes on like halfway through the season. And he's called the Zingbot, and he just comes in and like shoots one-liners at the guest, and is like, "Cody, like whatever, you're so crazy about Jessica." Like it's just like this one-liner. Everyone's like, "Oh shit, he actually went through that." You're Zingbot. You're Zackbot.
Oh, she's Zackbot.
I'm the Zackbot.
She's Zackbot.
That needs to be like a new part of the show. Just like in the middle, we'll just go around and Erin can just say something terrible about everybody. It'll be great.
It's like a burn and I'm the host. Like, what's it called? A roast?
A roast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A roast. All right.
Cool. Erin's not going to roast us. She'd start crying halfway through.
I will. Nobody will be laughing when Erin hosts the roast.
No, I'll be like, guys, it's not true. I didn't mean it.
You just start questioning your own existence.
I just, that was a Zackbot. I'm back. That's my job. There goes my job security.
Okay, so tonight I am drinking something called The Collection. My wife got it for me at Target. And I think she got it because she liked the bottle, which is how we acquire most of our wines. The back says, "The Collection combines the best of carefully harvested grapes and perfectly balanced wines, bringing together a delicate compilation of pure winemaking artistry. This creatively inspired red blend is the perfect addition to your backyard grilling. Try it with pork loin or smoky barbecue brisket." I won't be doing either of those things. I did just take a bite of my toddler's soggy Rice Krispie treat, so I wouldn't say it pairs well with that, but I'm hoping that it kills whatever else was on that Rice Krispie treat when he handed it to me. But it's pretty
probably
good so far.
Probably the 10 of the germs from the 10 other kids he was with today.
Mm-hmm. Bunch of Petri dishes running around. So if I'm not here next week, I've obviously died of something. So what about you, Jean, in process?
Well, I hit it pretty hard this weekend. Between
parents.
Well, between Thursday and Saturday, I had wine, craft beer, and tequila. And so tonight I'm doing it old lady style, and I put Bailey's espresso cream in my coffee. Mm-hmm. And it is just the right amount of sweetness. And for a chilly New England afternoon, it's just delightful.
I love Bailey's.
I do too. I love it too.
It's good stuff.
It's perfect way to wake
jealous.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on the completely opposite spectrum of the spectrum. I am drinking Smirnoff potato wine. It's a watermelon mint, a wonderful vintage.
I swear to God, Erin has been with us for like 4 months and she still doesn't understand how this works. We're the Weekly Wine Down. You're always drinking vodka.
You're drinking wine? I am drinking potato wine. I don't know why you guys think that this is not a thing. It's a thing, all right? I've been doing this whole stupid, like, low-carb bullshit, and doesn't have any carbs in it, so I don't feel like a complete loser after, like, killing myself all day not doing carbs, then, like, hey, here's a bottle of rosé. Like, I don't want to do that. So I just drank my potato wine. I'll tell you how later. So far, it's delicious.
You do you, girl.
Hey, yo.
What about you, Nicole?
Well, I'm drinking an Italian red blend called Alinera. And a lot of it is in Italian, so I had to go online and look up what it is. But I guess it is supposed to taste like cherries, coffee, and sweet tobacco. And it's supposed to have a touch of acidity. And I guess it kind of tastes like that. Not really. It's good. I'm not really getting the cherry or tobacco, but it's nice.
By her even going online and looking that up, she prepared more for her drink review than any of us have for any episode ever.
Ever. Well, I can't read the label, or I would have just read the label.
I'm just saying you bothered to do research, which is step above us.
It's the weekly wind down, right? So,
Nicole, your latest book, Shadows of a Dream, it came out in December, or came out this month, correct?
Yes, it sure did. And like for now, it's only on the BSB site, but the wide release will be soon, second Tuesday of the month. So you can't get it right now, just only on the BSB site.
Okay, why don't you tell us about it?
Sure. So it's a general fiction story, and it's about a musician named Rain. And so she's like a singer, pianist, and she's in a rock band, and she lives in an alley behind a bar. And so one night, her and her band is playing. She's like best friends with the owner of the bar, so her band always plays at this bar. And one night after they perform, she meets a painter named Giselle. And they got a couple artists, and they just fall super in love. But Giselle's got a pretty serious meth addiction, and that just puts them in all kinds of really treacherous and awful situations. And it's a pretty dark and grungy story, and it just deals with what it's like to be in that kind of almost first love type relationship that just turns your world upside down, but it's a toxic relationship, and kind of navigating your way through those questions about loyalty, when you stick by somebody who's going through someone versus when you need to have the self-respect to set some boundaries or maybe even walk away, and just kind of going through that in real time with her. It's set in first person present tense, so I just really wanted to capture what it's like in the moment, because I feel like those situations, normally we see them from the outside and it can feel very easy to just kind of say what needs to happen, but when you're in it, it's always very different. So I just wanted to kind of portray what that feels like.
God damn, learning boundaries. I know, right? Something we all need to
do. So anyway, and that's wonder why I drink wine, potato wine.
Yeah, you're going to need wine for this one.
So we got quite a few listener questions for you. Emma emailed and said, Secrets on the Clock focused on workplace romance. Is this something you have found yourself entangled in?
Yeah, I actually did meet my wife at work. I wouldn't really say it was similar to Secrets on the Clock in very many ways, other than, you know, kind of falling in love on the job and sort of keeping it on the down low at first. But for us, it was pretty different because we were really young and it was just a bowling alley. The stakes were not very high. No one was that concerned about it going poorly. But yeah, it is something I could draw on a little bit.
Hilarious.
Jean?
Speaking of addiction, one of our listeners, Jen, says that, again, with Secrets on the Clock, had a lot of focus on mental illness, alcoholism, and a ton of other issues. You discussed them all well and with a great amount of respect. How much research did you do on these topics to make sure you represented them well? And I'll have you answer that for Secrets on the Clock, but I'd also like you to answer it for the character with the meth addiction on your current one.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you. I'm really glad to hear that it came across that I put a lot of thought and, you know, research into it, because those are topics that I want to do right. I mean, obviously you want to do everything you do right, but those in particular can be sensitive. They can really wreck people's lives, and I didn't want to be insensitive in any way to any of those things. So research is a huge part of all of my books, and it can go, I try to do it in several different ways. I do just the standard kind of textbook looking up online or in books what it looks like, what the symptoms are of all the various different things from mental illness to addiction and everything else I've done. So that'll give me kind of like a clinical understanding of it that I think is important, and just physically what's going on with people, what can help, and just understanding what's going on scientifically. That's important to me. But more importantly, I would say, is kind of the personal side of that. You want to talk to people who are going through it or have gone through it. You want that touch of human in there, because it's not enough to be able to just list off how it works in the brain. You need to also know how it feels for the people going through it, for the people around them. That's something I always try to really focus on too, is not just to touch on the person with the addiction or the illness, but what that looks like for that whole community that is around them. we kind of lose track of that. It doesn't seem like as important to people. We got to take care of the person who's going through something. But being close to someone going through something is really hard too. So, I mean, I try to really just get as many angles as humanly possible. People who are going through it now, people who have recovered, people who have relatives or relationships with those type of people. I just try to find as many angles to come at it as humanly possible. And then once I've written it, give it back to them and see what their take is on it and see if I miss the mark, where I hit the mark, what kind of rang true for them or didn't.
So I have a question for you, kind of following up to that. Am I still muted? Oh, I thought I was still muted. I'm sorry.
No, we can hear you.
God, everybody's Zach-botting me right now, and I feel very offended.
I thought you were going to throw up a second ago, but I think you just sneezed.
Oh my! I have like this weird phlegmy cough. That's awesome and sexy. Mm-mm. Sorry, everyone. But no, my question, like, with the people that you choose, like, this may be too personal and you don't have to answer, but like, do you have these people already in your life, or do you kind of like go places where you know that this may be like an option to like sit down with someone and talk to them?
Some of both. I've had friends who have gone through some of these things, family that have gone through some of them. There are obviously people that I, or certain situations that I don't have anyone like that for, but I found that if you kind of talk to your community about what you're doing, everyone knows someone. Yeah. So as long as you're kind of vocal about what you're doing and make it clear that you're looking, they kind of tend to show up, and it's almost magical. I've never had to try that hard to find somebody to talk to about it.
Yeah, like almost like people want to kind of tell their story, and so it does come across correctly.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true as well that like, people, when they hear what you're doing, they get kind of excited about it, because a lot of books don't touch on those things. And people get excited when they hear someone's trying to do it. And especially if they hear that they're trying to do it well and they're looking for feedback, people more often than not are excited to talk to you and to tell you what they think about it.
Cool. Awesome. Is it me?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So, sorry. A reader, Melissa, hers to protect was a great story. I don't think I'd be able to get behind a drug dealer and a police officer being together, but I thought the fact that they knew each other as children made it more plausible. I love thrillers and mysteries, which is why I love Jackie D. Insert shameless pandering. What made you choose this storyline, and have you considered a sequel?
Thank you again. I really loved writing hers to protect. That's probably one of my most fun writing experiences. And it was, I think, because it was a thriller and it had a lot of action, and it was just kind of one of those stories that just came to me. Like, I wish I could explain exactly what made me decide to do that, but it just kind of was a story I had floating around in my head. And it was actually around NaNoWriMo time, National Novel Writing Month. And I decided I was going to just take this idea and run with it. And that kind of didn't leave a lot of room to overthink it. So you just kind of go. And I knew that I've always liked reunion romances, so, and second chance romances. So I knew that they were going to know each other from the past. And I just kind of wanted to play with that idea of, okay, you've been separated for years and now you're going to run into each other. What are some of the things that could just be shocking to you that could make it really hard to reconnect? You just start exploring conflicts. And that was one that I thought of that ended up being the one I went with. I thought it sounded like a lot of fun to write and like a compelling story.
Awesome.
Shadows of Jessica wants to had said, stated, asked, there was a statement and questions in here. Shadows of a Dream was Dissonance of a Minor. I love Shadows. Should I also read Dissonance? Are there differences, or it is the same story? And why did you publish under a different title?
So it was Dissonance in A Minor was the original title. And that one, I republished it because I made some changes. I loved that story. I always have. And I still love the original too, actually, in a lot of ways. So, I mean, I would say, yes, it's worth reading. It's actually not in print anymore. So if you want to read it, you will have to message me and I will hook you up with a copy, which I'm happy to do. But I do think it's worth rereading. It's a story difference. And the most major difference is the ending. it's a completely different ending. So on a line level through a lot of it, it's very similar and even the same for large chunks. So if that's not different enough to grasp, you know, your interest for the length of a book, that's understandable. So just know that going into it if you want to reread Dissonance. But I think that it's interesting, just kind of the two different takes when you're separated. It was originally published in 2013. So, I mean, once you've had some time away from it and you go back and look at that story, you know, you can kind of see different ways that it could have gone and maybe where it could have been improved. So I do think Shadows of a Dream is the better version, but I do also in a lot of ways still have love for the Dissonance and A minor version as well. And I'd be curious to see how people react to the two different endings.
We get questions on here pretty frequently for the authors that we have on about, like, if you could go back and rewrite any of your books, would you? And it's always interesting because I think, no, you put out the best thing you can at the time, but as you get older or learn more or better at what you do, yeah, you always kind of want to go back and change things or do something different. But then you're like, I don't know, do I want to mess with it? Because it was exactly what I could do at the time. I don't know. So it's interesting that you actually went back and did that. I think that's super cool that you took the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. A big part of it was just wanting to get it out again, because Dissonance and A minor went out of print. And I'm like, I really believe in this story still. So a lot of it was just wanting it to be out there again. But then once you do that, it's like, well, now it needs to represent the best I can do now. Mm-hmm. So you have to make some changes.
Yeah. That's actually what I was going to ask, is what kind of made you, like, prompted you to do that, you know, to go back into it?
Yeah. It was just that it's not available to people anymore. And I did have some people who knew me from it from back when it was out, and then it wasn't available anymore. And people will mention it every once in a while. And then new people who just discovered me are like, well, what's that? Where can I get that? And I didn't like having to say, well, you can't. So, so now it's out of Shadows of a Dream.
Which ones of your books would you guys go back and republish and rewrite?
Falling Into Her.
Really? I really like that one.
I just feel like the only reason is because it was my first, and it took me so long to
finish
it.
The first is always a little dirty and sloppy.
I know. But, like, I just feel like I really think that I could tighten it up now, but maybe not.
See more of you in that one, though, than anything else you've written.
Yeah, that was, like, literally,
Maybe that's why it's my favorite one of yours, because I can see you talking in it. Like, it's written in Aaron Zach's speak.
Yeah. Catherine is me. Hey, everybody that wants to read Aaron, go Falling Into Her. Sales are going to skyrocket. No, I'm just kidding.
What about you, Jean? Which one would you rewrite?
Well, I'd always be tempted to clean up Beatrice a little bit, and there are scenes that I read now and they're rushed, and I would go back and I would flesh out the scene a little bit more. So that was just like a mechanical part of it. But I would love to rewrite Summer Fling and make her less angsty, because people apparently don't like when I do angsty. So I'm kind of staying away from that based on the reviews that I got from Summer Fling, because it was not received the way I had hoped it would be. So that would be the one that I would really change if I could.
I would change Land's End, because it was the only contemporary romance I've ever written. And I it's the only book of mine that I don't, when people ask about it, I'm like, I don't read that one. Because it's just not... It was received
so you
okay.
You would put some explosions in it.
I would put some explosions in it.
Yep, that sounds pretty accurate.
There's still a killer in it, but it's not the main storyline. But it's the only one that I read it. It's the only one of mine that I'm like, I would redo this now, having read more contemporary romance than I did at the time. That's the only one.
But does anyone pull a blade from a sheath?
No, but they do plenty in Spellbound.
Okay.
Insert game look plug.
All right, Jean, it's yours last question.
Wait, right. There's actually two. You skipped one.
I did?
Yeah, Kathy.
Oh, shoot. Sorry.
Oh, you're fine. Jean, you do Kathy. I'll do Meg.
Okay.
Yeah. Kathy, as Aaron says,
Kathy.
She says, a main theme throughout your books is loyalty. What do you consider the most honorable traits among not just your characters, Nicole, but people in your life? And also, what are the worst? Meaning, if you're going to write a bad guy, what is a must-have characteristic? So let's do the good qualities first, and then tell us your deep-seated bad guy.
Okay. Well, good qualities. You kind of already hit it with that. I am a big fan of loyalty. I think that that's really important. That's what I look for in the people around me. I try to be very loyal myself, and it's just an admirable quality, I think, when someone really has someone else's back. I always am attracted to that. And especially when that person's not there, you know, it's one thing to be loyal to someone's face, but what are you doing the rest of the time? So when a character is truly fiercely loyal, I'm pretty much on board. I love seeing that. Other good qualities. I love people who are honest, because that's not easy. That's a difficult thing to do. I mean, not all the time, but, you know, there's lots of situations where it would probably be easier to kind of, you know, maybe answer in a manipulative way or kind of skirt around an issue or whatever. Like, it takes courage to just be authentic and honest with whatever is in your face, no matter what the consequences might be. Mm. So that's something
that
I really
admire.
See, Aaron,
it's because I love you.
That is so true. I was literally, you were in my head. I'm not joking.
And I like bold. I like bold characters, characters that are not afraid, that can make big moves, that, again, just make their decisions based on what they think or feel is right versus any kind of fear or trying to save themselves some kind of turmoil. And then negative qualities, you know, I mean, any kind of maliciousness, which usually I feel like comes from insecurity or something a little bit different. But anytime a character that truly just wants to hurt someone, that's a little unnerving. That's not something we usually see. And it can be scary. I try to connect that with some kind of human quality, because usually people aren't just evil. But when whatever the underlying cause is, like insecurity may be, when that comes across as meanness or any just kind of willful hurting of people, that's I find that to be an unnerving characteristic to see in someone. And I'd say another one would be just manipulation and calculation. Someone that's really self-serving and thoughtful about what they're doing in a way that is meant to harm others or to give themselves some kind of gain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a real difference, especially when you're writing characters, and you can definitely, it translates on the pages, between someone who's intentionally manipulative and someone who doesn't realize they're being manipulative for their own gain. And I mm-hmm. think the most devastating characters are the ones who are intentionally, because I think we've all encountered those people, and you don't realize that they play bad guys in your story, and that sucks because you don't realize it at the time.
Yeah, very, very, very.
So, what
true.
Characteristic do you for the bad guys always has to be there?
You know, I wouldn't say any of them always has to be there, because I try to make them as different as I can. And in Shadows of a Dream, they're really. Isn't a traditional bad guy. I mean, she's addicted to a drug. I've often said that the drug itself is kind of the bad guy of Shadows of a Dream. So it's kind of tough for me to answer that one, because it's always a little bit different. I try to just focus on making them human, and whatever their negative qualities may be, to base them in some kind of history that made them that way.
So you don't believe people are born evil?
I think it's very rare. I suppose that, yeah, there could be something physically wrong with your brain that might make you not have compassion or whatever. But in general, the vast majority of the time, I don't think people are born evil or even just categorically evil. It's usually somewhere in between.
Yeah.
You're a better person than me, Nicole.
I was just going to say, this sounds like a debate that Nicole and Jackie could have for the rest of the podcast. No,
not a debate.
I like her optimism. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I ever accidentally do something shitty to someone, I'll revert back to Nicole's
Aaron.
Words. But I am
not. You know what? She's going to say me right here.
I am not inherently evil. my insecurities frothing to the top.
That, literally, that whole description is me. Look, I've just burned myself.
Burn. No, you didn't.
You're like, no.
That's the lamest burn ever.
It's not a burn when it's true, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, right.
Anyway, so let's go to Meg's question. So Meg says, the other ladies on the podcast, oh, we have a frequent listener, discuss the difficulty in writing sex scenes. Is it the same for you? What are some of the ways you get through them? I'm working on writing my first book and would appreciate some insight.
I don't hate sex scenes the way a lot of people I hear do. I mean, I don't love them or hate them. I think they're kind of like, not just like any other scene, but I kind of approach them in the same way. Like, what is going to just happen? Like, just choreograph it so you know where everyone is and everything makes sense. And then also just kind of what's the emotional level? Is there going to be something that goes wrong? Is there a conflict? Is it emotional? Just, I set it up like I do with most scenes. And then the challenge is to go back afterwards and try to make sure that it flows. It's not too much like your other sex scenes. I think that's probably the hardest part, is making sure that your sex scenes don't all end up just being carbon copies of each other. But in general, I don't find them all that much harder than any other scene. And it seems like sometimes they just work well the first time. Other times you've got to work them over a lot. But I experience that with all my scenes.
I think the anticipation of sex scenes sometimes is a little bit too much. I have just as much difficulty writing sex scenes as I would like a major action scene that I want to get right and make sure that everything kind of goes the way I want it to. And because I write action and mystery and thrillers, I have to make sure that they're not the same in every single book over and over. And I mean, I think we all have styles that we kind of stick to, like, you can tell the difference between like the way I write versus the way Ali Valley writes when it comes to like an action scene. Like, we all have a certain thing that we kind of stick to, but I think people psych themselves up too much over writing sex scenes. Like, just write them. And then change them later if you need to, depending on the characters and, you know, whatever.
I think too, because like, especially in like a romance novel and even an action novel or a thriller or mystery, like, those scenes that the reader has been waiting for this entire time, like, they have literally gone this entire journey with you to see them in their mind have sex. Like, they want to be excited about this.
In contemporary romance, that might be true.
Yes, in contemporary romance, for sure. That is the reason. Like, they want that. I mean, like, that's what I would think. Like, because that's why I'm reading them. Like, I want to see these characters get together in an intimate fashion beyond kissing. And I feel like that first sex scene holds so much weight. It can make or break the novel. And so I just really, truly feel that I offended Jean. What happened?
She just bounced. She was tired of listening to you. Hold on, let me push stop.
Fault, and as I said to Aaron, I swear I paid my bill. It's not one of those situations.
Oh, I thought you said I sort of need to pay my bill.
Oh, no, I said I did pay my bill.
I was like, well, you know, sometimes it's the last bill I pay at work, so.
I don't want you busies assuming that I didn't pay my bill, and that's why I got cut off in the middle of the podcast.
We're recording again, so.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Carry on.
So the sex scene is super important.
I think the hardest part about sex scenes is actually reading them after the fact, realizing everyone you know is reading them. That's when I like to curl up and
like my 87-year-old dad.
Yeah.
Same. When my stepdad, I didn't know he read my book, and then he was just like, "Oh, I love that you named the dog Dorothy," and I'm like,
Okay, first of all, don't let them, men reading it is not a big deal.
I know, but it's just like, he's my stepdad.
They pay for it normally.
But I'm not producing what they're paying for. That's the difference.
Very true. Very, very true.
Do you have any insight about sex scenes, Jean?
I have to say that I'm with you guys, and I'm not a fan of them. However, there is a sex scene that I wrote in Spellbound, and I really enjoyed writing it.
Which one?
And I am I don't want to give away any spoilers. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it was you know, the characters, it was a unique situation. So it was unlike anything that I had done before. So that made it a little more interesting. And plus, this was my first real sex scene in a novel. I'd written them before in other stuff, but usually I'm fade to black.
I think,
but
you
I figured
it.
I could. Thank you. And you know if what? I get any flack, I'm just gonna say you wrote them.
You know what? I'm starting Spellbound tonight, so I'll tell you. I'll be the judge.
Okay.
Hey, my mother, who is pretty, she'll tell me what she likes and does not like about my books, like down to like the paragraph. She had the highest praise so far for Spellbound. So
that's because there were no comma splices, Jackie D.
Oh, I got zacked.
I activated the Zach bot.
Yeah, you did.
Nicole,
my God.
I may have a problem with comma splices.
Who doesn't?
Jean does not.
Okay.
Actually, Jackie, to be honest, I read what you wrote just recently, and I didn't find one comma splice.
Wow.
Hey, yo.
I did not find one, but after we're done recording, I'll tell you what I did find. That you better cut the fuck out.
Talk about, okay, Nicole, next time we're all together, like in a common area, Jean will do her her comma lesson. If you need help at all, I'm not saying
excellent.
You do. Listen
well,
to me. Like,
hey, if she doesn't have problems with it, she's the first writer I know who doesn't, because that's just a thing that just happens when you're writing.
She's an English teacher. So
oh, okay. Okay.
Like
that explains it right there.
Right. Yeah. So, like, we sat down. We had, like, we had literally, like, I don't know, 17 between the three of us lemon drops under our belts.
Oh, yeah.
And we were the loudest, most rambunctious people in the bar, but we learned about commas. I learned so much.
Teaching grammar while being drunk on martinis was truly the highlight of my life.
And Jean, you can tell I actually learned from you.
I know. That was a beautiful experience. It truly was. It touched me in all the inside warm, fuzzy places.
Oh. I took a turn quickly.
I was going to say, no, that was later in the bedroom. But that
must be my Bailey's nip that's making me get saucy.
Yeah, yo. The espresso cream is really kicking in.
Erin is offended. She just got up and walked away.
I'm out. Sorry. I dropped my notes. I'm taking notes. God.
Are you kidding me? You're actually taking notes?
Literally even putting them on note cards. Like that's, I've only got two.
Do you have a highlighter too?
No, it's just, they're just like lined.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They're fancy.
Erin's responsible for taking notes throughout our podcast, and she typically, well, she doesn't. So.
Not a lot. I started, so like Stacey used to take notes, and then she was like, okay, well, Erin, do you want to do notes? And I was like, sure. I don't know why I said yes. I don't take notes. I never took notes during college either. Like I would just listen. But I wasn't drinking.
No, we have to work on that.
But I wasn't drinking then during class.
If anyone wants to hire Erin, she's available. Her attention to detail is stellar.
Just don't let me drink on the job, all right? People are, anyway.
So what's going on with everyone this week?
Again.
Jean, we'll start with you.
What am I obsessed with this week?
No, just what's going on.
Come on, tell us about your life.
Today, this was not a good week, and I was hoping that it was a full moon that I could blame it on and at least find some sort of comfort knowing that.
Is it something in retrograde?
Is it still that fucking retrograde again?
I don't know.
Is it still? I gotta tell you, having aging parents sucks really bad. And you know what, I realized, and I was just discussing this with my friends this morning because we went out to breakfast and, you know, we're all the same age. We all graduated high school together. All of us were all talking about what severe medical issues their parents had that we had to help out with. And I came to the conclusion that you really only have one really good, strong, solid decade. And I just left it. So if I had any illusions of cutting down drinking, I realize now that's not going to happen. And so
silver lining and all that. And
that's good. I now have an excuse to overdrink and not feel guilty about it. Amen.
All right, good time bear. Does anybody have some honey for Gene?
Hey, you fucking asked.
No, Gene, what you're going through, it's really hard. Watching anyone get older is hard, especially when they're your parents or grandparents that are like parents or whoever. It's not a good feeling. It's one of those gut checks of mortality that is hard to kind of absorb and get through, and it's not fair. So I'm sorry you're going through it.
That's okay. I love you for your constant support and understanding. And, I try to bring a sense of humor to it because why not? Everybody likes a good fart in church. So, you know, I try to keep it light. And, and then it did remind me of my mortality. It reminded me how someday, if nobody does a wellness check, I will be dead on a floor and my cat will be asleep and purring on my hip. I saw my future in that 3-panel meme of what your cat does when you die. That's my future. And then this past week, I was just again reminded of my mortality. And then I had the conversation with some younger friends, one of whom works at a hospital. When you see me start to go, take a little bottle of propofol from the hospital and make it easy on me.
Number one, check on Gene regularly. Let me write that down in my notes. Jesus, Gene Copeland.
Well, you know, if I'm not posting something foul or offensive on Facebook for more than 2 days, you better call on a wellness check.
All right, I'm on it. Let me put that in my reminders.
Hey, Siri. What about you, Erin?
I'm going to follow that up. well, I'm just, I've been writing a lot. Like, I technically have a January 1 deadline for the current book I'm on, and I still have,
Erin,
like, 10,000.
It's December.
Yeah, I know. Okay. And I still have like 10,000 words to write.
Oh, that's not bad.
Erin writes eight fucking books a year. 30 days is nothing for her.
10,000 words, you can knock that out in one Panera sitting.
I really can. Yeah. I mean, honestly, two. Let's be real. Two, I'll be done. And that's fine. And then I can get it to my beta readers and be fine. But it's like, I have never hated two characters before in my whole life. And I hate them both so much. And I'm really worried that I'm not going to be able to redeem either one of them in the next 8,000 words. So I'm kind of freaking out about it, which is why I procrastinated today. And I baked, like, with Gail, like, 3 different things. We, like, did chocolate cookies and chocolate chip cookies.
Wait a minute. You don't like either of your characters?
No, I just, like, I like them, but I just don't, like, see, this is my problem. So, like, when I wrote in the past, I would, like, reread everything I wrote, and then, like, I would rewrite everything I wrote because I was never really thinking I would ever make it to the end, you know, because it was, like, a pipe dream that you would ever get, like, published, you know, like, oh, my God, I'm going to get published, you know.
Erin, you
so,
put
like,
out my 3 books a year.
Well, but listen, so, like...
Very kindly, fuck off, ma'am.
Oh, yes. Okay. So now I see how you guys were like, oh, but she's going to Zach burn you all these times, but literally, we're just going to burn the fuck out of her. I get it. Thank you for inviting me to this bullshit party. So anyway, my point is, like, I used to, like, reread everything as I was writing it. Like, I'd reread it and then start writing. But, like, because I'm always constantly on a deadline now, I never do that. So, like, I don't know if they work together. But in my mind, presently, they don't.
What
so
if I tell probably, you? You got to take a break.
I know. I already had this contract signed, so I couldn't. I mean, you know, with next. Burn.
You just there got you just got deleted out anyway. I don't know. Skype edited you for once. Yeah, Skype was like, this bitch. We can't.
Thank you, Skype.
Thanks, Skype.
Skype said this bitch.
Aaron, listen to me. It is better to tell Bold Strokes that this is going to be late and you have some work you need to do than put out something you don't like.
Oh, I 100% agree. And Sandy already told me if I need an additional month, I can have it. She said, we can put you on a February 1 deadline. So if I, in the next like 5 days, don't get this buttoned up, I will ask for an extension. I promise you. Because I'm not going to put out a piece of shit. I don't put out pieces of shit. I don't put out turds. I don't put out random fucking cookie cutter bullshit. Like,
try some flaxseed in your salad.
Flaxseed. I love fiber.
Nicole, how are you doing this week?
Man, now I got to follow both of them. So we moved a couple of weeks ago, and that's pretty much consuming everything we're doing right now, trying to get unpacked and get the house to where it's not a total disaster, because I'm just a little bit, like, not OCD, but a little tiny bit. Like, it drives me crazy to have boxes around and stuff. So that's pretty much what I've been doing 24/7, is just trying to make the house not a complete disaster, and reading and getting ready to start a new book. But right now I'm just kind of, you know, doing some loose outlining and scene sketches and stuff, but working up to writing. Probably starting next week, I'll get going on some actual real chapters.
It's always exciting in the beginning, isn't it?
Yes.
What's your least favorite part of the writing process?
You know, it's funny because every process, like every part of the process I get to, I like end up saying on Facebook, like, oh, I love this part. And I say that like for every single one, and I caught myself doing it. And I'm like, you can't say they're all your favorite, but I guess my least favorites.
You make us look mad.
I like almost all of it, though, because like I get sick of all of them, and then I like to be on the next phase, really, is just what it is. So I love like the outlining and dreaming phase, and but then I get sick of that and I'm really excited to write. And then I get sick of that and I'm really excited to edit. And then I get sick of that. I mean, I guess editing's probably my least favorite out of all of them.
Yep.
Page proofs.
Yep.
Page proofs are easy.
No, whatever, you send them to your mom.
Editing's the worst part. Editing's the worst part.
Validate that.
I actually really love the editing part.
My mom's a machine.
I really like the page proof part, actually, because that's like the first time I could read it as a reader. Like, I could kind of like, you have to turn off the writer thing because it'll drive you insane because you can't change it that much at that point. So you have to go into reader mode.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe that's what I need to focus on, because like at that point I'm like, I mean, I do get caught up in the story because I'm such a good writer. I'm just joking. It was totally just, I said that to be a dick. I'm just saying.
Raise your hand if you think Aaron needs a therapist.
I would like the record to show that no one raised their hand.
You would like
False.
It to show.
Yeah.
I would like it, but that's not everyone raised their hand, even Nicole. Thanks, Nicole.
Non-factual.
I'm just joking. No, but like, I feel like the page proof part, like, I don't know why, but like, I always get like so caught up in like everything that I'm like, oh my God, I forgot to look for errors. You know, that's what I end up doing. And then I don't know. Maybe I need to do what you say and like get
Send
more
to
like.
My mom.
I might. Hey, Donna.
Hey, girl. Hey. She'd do it for you. She loves you.
No, I love Donna. She's like my girl. She's my home girl.
We owe her some drinks anyway, not only from GCLS last year, but also for all her page proofing.
She's a machine, that one. I'm obsessed with this week. Two things. One, the Facebook group I sent you guys, where it's a bunch of like millennials pretending to be baby boomers.
That was hilarious.
It's the funniest thing I've ever read. Like, I'm crying laughing about it. It's like they post blurry pictures and they're like, this is my new grandchild, Emma. And it's just, it's so like funny. And it brings me so much joy. I love it so much. Whenever I'm like real burnt out at work, I go to that Facebook page and I'm like, let's see what these assholes are doing. And it always just brightens my day. And the other thing I'm obsessed with, obviously, is that,
I love it. Oh, I'm frozen. I'm frozen.
Spellbound is available on NetGalley starting today, which means that if you want to read it for free and leave a review, you can. It's a book that Jean and I wrote together. It's about some time traveling witches. Neither of us have ever written in the paranormal genre, so it was a fun exercise for us. It's about some time traveling witches and kind of the plague of the world ending and kind of the darkest evil that's existed on the planet. And it all kind of comes together. Of course, there's things that blow up and things that get killed. And I love
and
that
knives part. Removed from sheets.
Yes, lots of knives. And it was a lot of fun to write. So I'm really excited about how this one, it's very funny. Jean, I'm sure you've picked up on, is hilarious. So she's funnier than Aaron and I. She is Aaron.
Another Zach Byrne. Jesus.
Jean is legitimately funnier than either of us.
Oh my God. Jean is the funniest person I've ever met. Like, she makes me cry. I laugh so hard sometimes.
What the fuck do you two want from me? I want to know right now.
So if you...
I don't want you to pay my bills. Hey-o, there it is. It is Burn Burn.
That's not, you don't even know when you're burning. You've been stuck on this all night, and that's not even.
That's not it.
That's just regular, just talking shit. That's not a burn.
That's not it.
Your burns come when you don't realize you're burning them, and then you realize you just said the most offensive thing possible in that moment.
Oh.
Jesus.
Jackie's coming in hard, Aaron. Jackie's coming in hard.
Jesus. I feel like this is my first time. What am I, a virgin tonight? Fuck.
Aaron's deep into the watermelon vodka right now.
Right?
I could see, Jesus. I see the difference. Aaron 1 was when we started the podcast, and Aaron 2 is how we finish.
I think there's a 3 in there, don't you?
You're the updated version with lots of watermelon mint vodka in your belly.
Listen, are we talking about any sort of politics right now? Or are we almost done? What's
Let's
our
do
status?
It.
What the fuck is going on right now? I need you guys to update me right now. What is going on? Because I feel like articles of impeachment are coming.
Okay.
Then you have Republicans saying one thing. You have the Democrats.
So full disclosure, I have been asked this probably 15 times this week. And here is my thought process on it. He is going to be impeached in the House. Okay. Nancy Pelosi is going to draw up articles of impeachment and they're going to impeach him, which means he will go to trial in the Senate. He's
and
not going to get impeached in the
anything.
Senate.
Right.
He will not, he's not leaving office under impeachment. They are not going to hold him accountable because they have approved 208 lifetime appointment judges while he, under his reign. And yes, I use that phrase intentionally.
Yeah.
They're not going to turn on him. Okay. But the benefit of it is that all of the cards are kind of on the table now. And like we have said on here before, his supporters are always going to be his supporters. The people against him are always going to be against him. What this entire process is for are the people in the middle, the independents, who need to be swayed. The people who may have voted for him, but also voted for Obama, who possibly voted for Clinton, but also voted for, or Obama and possibly Romney, Clinton, like there's all these people, the independent voters. Those are the people everyone's trying to win right now, because those are the people who decided the last election. So putting all of this on the table is because 77,000 votes in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, Hillary Clinton's president.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
That's the difference.
But can I ask one question? So like what?
Only one.
What?
Make it good. Think about it.
What does the Senate Okay, so like, let's say the Senate votes, they impeach. They've decided to go forward, right?
They're laughter. Senate is lousy with Republicans.
Okay, let's say they do. Perfect world.
What is the fallout from that, and why wouldn't they? Because in my mind, I feel like so many Republicans.
Here's the fallout. Here's the fallout. People are their base, which is Trump supporters, is so disheartened. They do not show up to vote at the 2020 election, and the Democrats win by a landslide. They have to go defend Trump to prove their worth, or they don't come out for them. If they feel betrayed by the Republican senators, they run the chance of losing office and they run the chance of losing the presidency. That they're counting, they need for Trump to win again, or for even Pence to win again. Even if he were to get removed, for Pence to remain in office in 2020, they need the support of their base. So if they vote to impeach him, they lose that support.
So it literally has nothing to do with America and like making us better. It has everything to do with them just getting a fucking another seat.
1,000%. What have the Republicans ever been concerned about?
Well, that's what I'm thinking, but that's also like I always want to hope for the best, right? You always want to hope for the best. But I mean, you're always expecting.
You are a sweet Disney loving soul.
I hope for the best. I always expect the worst. Always.
What do you think?
That's my motto.
Oh, God. Pretty much what she said. I don't expect it to actually happen. Like, it feels kind of like a show, which is annoying, you know, because it feels just very fake and like no one actually expects it to happen, you know. So I kind of am trying to distance myself from it and just let this whole charade pass and then go from there.
Yeah, the actors are all playing their parts.
Yep.
And Aaron's innocent question, it was so sweet and innocent. She goes, you mean they really don't care about America and they're just going to vote for their own self-interest?
You threw the Disney princess.
You, oh my God, you were such a Disney princess with that level of sincerity. And welcome to American Government and Politics 101.
So here's the difference, too, because we can go back. There has been, this is the fourth impeachment that has taken place in our country's history. The first one was Johnson back in the 1800s. We'll ignore that one. Okay, then comes Richard Nixon, then Clinton, and now Trump. Yep. Okay, here's the difference with Richard Nixon. He had a ton of support from the Republicans, like you would expect, just like Clinton did. Clinton had a ton of support from the Democrats. Up until Nixon was actually caught red-handed with those tapes saying what he said. So the transcripts that came out are the equivalent to those tapes, okay? The difference now, though, is there is an entire propaganda machine working on behalf of the president and his party, telling people, this is what you heard, but don't pay attention to that because this is what it meant. And because our brains take shortcuts to validate any emotions or predetermined thought processes that we have, they will go there. It is easier for them because it aligns with their beliefs to think the president may have said this, but he never meant it. And it's easy to prove that because he has said A, B, C, D, and E, but I love him, so it doesn't matter. It's a very, and we've said this on here before, it's a very battered wife syndrome kind of situation where it doesn't matter how much damage and pain he is inflicting. They believe still that he is not only the best choice, but their only choice. Right. So that is the kind of mentality and mental illness they're in. And I don't mean this in any kind of joking way or they're in a cult. They are legitimately in a cult where this man can do no wrong. And I will admit, some of the stuff he's done, I actually agree with. He just passed it that it's a felony charge now for animal abuse. I actually agree with that. And I'm a big enough person to agree with that. But even a broke clock is right twice a day. So I can put that I can put that aside and say, even though that one piece of legislation is something that I agree with, and I'm willing to acknowledge that it's what I agree with, it still doesn't erase the xenophobia, the racism, the homophobia, and take all the isms and phobias out. He is doing long-term permanent damage to the state of America in the world. Like, this man left the G7 conference like a boy with a Ball, who didn't get to play because mm-hmm. Justin Trudeau said he holds up meetings because he's doing press conferences.
Right.
None of that was false. All of that was true.
Just because he said it with like a joking tone.
He got his feelings hurt by the cool kids and he left. And
that... you can't confront a narcissist with the truth. Mm-mm. That never goes over well.
Sure. Which is why he panders to other authoritarian leaders, because authoritarian leaders aren't questioned. Everyone just says yes and smiles and nods and does whatever they ask. And that is what he wants, because he doesn't want any type of pushback. For example, look at Abraham Lincoln. This was a president who surrounded himself when he got elected. He actually brought people into his cabinet that actively were going against him. They were trying to rally votes to not put him in office. And he did that because he consistently wanted to hear the other side of the argument. It was important to him to not only hear yes from people, but why we shouldn't. Our government only functions at its best when there is a gas and there is a break. Okay. Mm-hmm. There is a place in this country for conservative thought. There is also a place for liberal thought. You need both, because both point out issues that the other would not have thought of. The problem with this is that it is fundamentally broken. They're not going on conservative values. They're going on Trump values, which are an entirely different thing.
Yeah.
And we are the laughingstock of the world right now. And America has never been in that position. Ever.
Nope. Never. Yeah, never, ever.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays. Like my personal opinion is that him storming out of the G7 will have more of an impact than the phone calls itself on his supporters. Because they don't like to be looked at as weak. They don't like to be looked at as being like, you know, teased out of a place, because they have different values. They want to be the strong one. They want to be the ones that are seeing that they will punch you in the teeth if you do something wrong. And the fact that he didn't confront Trudeau, he just walked away like a giant baby, will have more of an impact than anything else.
Yeah. You know, the bullies are always the one that love Trump, the bullies. They're the ones that, like, you know, he's right. You know, he said everything correctly. He is the be all end all. That's the guy that made everyone else cry on the playground. He's not right, but he is the one.
Don't you think his supporters will spin that whole G7 summit
someone will spin it for them?
Trump is too big, too important to put up with their shit, so he said what was on his mind and he got up and got out of there and went back to doing America's work. That's how they'll spin it.
I think so. There's been a lot of polls done. I don't know if does anyone here listen to Pod Save America?
No.
Okay, you 100% should. It's very, very good. But these guys, they all worked for Obama. Before that, they worked on like the Kerry campaign, the Clinton campaign. Like, they're lifelong political hacks, essentially.
Okay.
And what they did a whole series of polls, and what the lead podcaster actually did was he did a podcast series called In the Wilderness about like the history of the Democratic Party and where we go from here and why Hillary Clinton lost and yada, yada, yada. I'm not going to plug them anymore because they make millions. but he did a series.
One day we will.
He did a series of focus groups where he asked Obama Trump voters like their reasons for voting, like what made you change, what drove you away from the Democratic Party over to Trump and yada, yada. And then he has come back to them since then and said, how do you feel about it now? You know, 3.5 years later, how are you feeling? And this is who we have to be worried about, are these independent voters that don't have party loyalty and they vote with whoever moves them emotionally. Their number one concern is that they do not want to be the laughingstock of the world. They're embarrassed by Trump. They find him embarrassing. They don't like that the other world leaders are making fun of him. And it's not in support of him saying, oh, poor Trump. They're saying, get your shit together. You're embarrassing us. And they don't want to feel like that. So all of these little tantrums may play well to his base, but it will not play well to the voters he needs. And his biggest problem is he's not focusing on the voters he needs. He's worried about rallying his base. And that is going to, if the Democrats put up a decent candidate, that will be his downfall. And I hate to say this, and I will vote for him if he ends up being the candidate, Joe Biden is not it. He's not. He doesn't inspire.
He's not it.
He does not inspire. But
no.
If he is who we pick, I will hold my nose and vote for him. I 100% will.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's so funny, I'm not a purist. He doesn't need to check on my boxes. He just doesn't. But
like, the thing he doesn't need to check your boxes?
Hey.
Or smell my hair, which he's very creepy.
Or yeah, and don't even get those crossed. You don't even want him sniffing your box either.
I don't need you to sniff my box. Yeah. Oh my god. So here's something that like is so funny to me. Well, not funny, but like when we talk about inspirational. Obviously, I think I've made it very clear that I'm 100% for Elizabeth Warren right now. Like. There was a video of her on her Instagram account of when a young girl asked her what she feels and how she would approach someone who doesn't agree with her, including a parental figure or someone very close to her. And the story that Elizabeth Warren then tells is about how she married a man in her past that her parents didn't agree with. And it's not, I don't think it's her current husband, but I think it was a person that she just did not fundamentally get along. And like her parents saw that and she went against what her parents believed in. And she said, like, I was wrong. Like my parents were right. But at the same time, like it was the fact that we fought about it and we were upset about it. And she's like, and I understand that. And I get it. And she got all choked up and the girl was crying. She was like a high school age girl. And like, they were both crying and she's like, come up here and give me a hug at the end. And it's that sort of emotion that I like to see in someone that is representing me. Like, I'm voting for you to represent me. And like, that is one thing that, like, unfortunately, Joe Biden, as much as I think he's a cute guy and like, oh,
he's
yeah, you
Joe.
Love
yeah.
Obama. Yeah, he's great. Like, but I feel like there have been uncles in my life that I didn't really love.
Here's the thing with Joe Biden. Okay. And here are the points for him. And I'm not a Joe Biden supporter.
Right.
He has proven himself on the world stage. People feel comfortable with him. And the biggest mm-hmm. base of the Democratic Party is Black women. Okay. Mm-hmm. Black women are fiercely loyal. Fiercely, fiercely loyal to the people that they believe in. And because he was part of the Obama administration, their loyalty now and always will lie with Joe Biden. Bernie Sanders plays slightly better than Elizabeth Warren with Black Americans. Pete Buttigieg actually plays the worst. So you're going to kind of see. Here's the other thing, too. People don't pay attention to politics very closely at this point. We do, because we have to talk, because people continue to get their news from us, and you really need to stop doing that.
You need to stop.
You need to stop doing that. I mean,
I
you see Aaron
Instagram.
With her.
Instagram.
Yeah, you see Aaron. Don't get your news
from
her.
You don't see me, but you hear me. And that's enough.
But Joe Biden is familiar, and he's comfortable, and he has not disappointed them, unless you go all the way back to the busing issues and stuff that Kamala Harris so eloquently outlined. He has been dependable for them. And unfortunately, because of the lives that many Black Americans have had to lead, they believe that only another white man can beat another white man. And a lot of people are voting scared at this point, because it's not necessarily about who the candidate is. It's who can beat Donald Trump. And
right,
they believe that Joe Biden is the only choice. They may not even necessarily want to vote for him as much as they want Trump out of office. And people are voting on fear this time. That's all it is. If Obama had run when Bush won the second time, he would not have won. He wouldn't have won, because people weren't basing it on hope and change and all of these things. Like, he was too new to the game. They weren't familiar enough with him. They weren't comfortable enough with him. He didn't have enough of a proven track record. He came in at the perfect time in 2008. He would not have won in 2004. So the when you're in a mid cycle, it is very, very rare that that presidents do not get reelected. So it has to be the right person. And that is what people are voting based on. They're comfortable with Biden. And unfortunately, Elizabeth Warren reminds a lot of people of Hillary Clinton.
And that's so sad to me because even though I love Hillary, Hillary is one of my very favorite, I would say very favorite, like, I don't know, I don't want to say popular, but just like political figures that are famous, you know, like I love everything about Hillary Clinton. Like I there are certain things that like I question, but like, I also like, I respect her because she is strong. She is this woman that I can look up to, but tell you now, I would pick Elizabeth Warren hands down because I feel like Elizabeth Warren has this emotional like ability to like say like these are the things that I 100% agree with, and I may have switched my, you know, changed my mind over the years. I think maybe that was Hillary's downfall, is like she would not say, yeah, I fucking switched my mind. Are you kidding me? But I think like a lot of times, like Elizabeth Warren comes across as this person that like has these like skittish background things that people are scared of. I'm like, are you kidding me? So she thought she had some Native American blood in her. That's the fucking thing that you're going to make her this villain about? Like, that's bullshit. Like, it's so frustrating and sad. It's so frustrating because it's like there are some people in this world that are out to make America fall. They don't give a fuck about you as a person, as a voter. And you're going to be upset because Elizabeth Warren at one point thought she had some Cherokee fucking Indian in her. Like, let's not that. Be real.
Okay, so you have to remember that who they're aiming for. So early on in the primary process, the very, very liberals are the ones who are paying attention because they are the ones who want Trump out most desperately. So they're rallying behind certain candidates.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
As this progresses, the it's going to start shifting, unfortunately, and it's not fair, and I'm not saying that it is, but to white working class, not college educated white males. That is the primary demographic because that makes up a huge swath of the voting population. And it's very hard to appeal to both black women and white, non-college educated white males. Like, so in Elizabeth Warren, I love Elizabeth Warren. I had said when Hillary Clinton was running, if Elizabeth Warren threw her hat in the race, I would go work for her. I would quit my job and literally go work for her. I love Elizabeth Warren. I don't know in 2020 if she has what it takes to beat Trump. I don't know if she does. I think he did. I think Kamala Harris had it.
Yeah.
But her campaign was mismanaged. Okay. So I unfortunately, now I'm going to vote for Elizabeth Warren in the primaries because I live in California and I have the ability to kind of do whatever, because it's not really that consequential of how things turn out. But I believe the person who is going to be who could beat Trump, and it shows in poll after poll after poll, unfortunately, unless something drastically changes, is Joe Biden. I don't like it. I don't like
it. Biden-Warren ticket. Now, can you see Elizabeth Warren mopping the floor with Pence in a fucking debate?
I honestly think if Biden gets the nomination, he will tap Harris for VP. He's gonna tap Harris. If Biden was smart, if Biden was smart to keep up with the Obama coalition, if he was the nomination, he would tap Harris. That's my personal. Nicole, what do you think? I see you nodding your head a lot.
I think that would be interesting, and that could probably have the potential to do it. But I think that you're exactly right that people, like a ton of people, are just more interested in getting Trump out than they are in any of the candidates. And that's kind of a sticky situation that I think we see election after election, is it's, well, what's the lesser evil? And I think that that's a situation people are really frustrated with being in. And I think a lot of people quit voting because of it. I think that's a huge part of why people quit voting. But now Trump has scared everyone into, okay, even if I do hate them both, I need to vote because I hate him more. But it's just it's an unfortunate way to go to the polls, though. It's just to be like, well, whoever's not Trump because he scares the living hell out of me. Right. You know, I think we're we're all hoping that someone is going to show up that we just adore. But I think the vast majority of people right now are just anything but Trump.
Well, and to be perfectly honest, I completely agree with you, Nicole. None of it actually matters unless you get rid of the Republican Senate. None of it matters. Because right, you could have Warren in there. You could have Warren and Harris as VP and president. And I don't care which order that goes in. But you can have both of them in there. But if Mitch McConnell is still at the helm of the Senate, none of it matters because it will all die. He prides himself. He tells the press that he is the Grim Reaper. His biggest objective when Obama was in office was to make sure nothing got passed. So it doesn't matter unless you vote Amy McGrath in Kentucky.
Yes.
You have to get rid of Mitch McConnell. And even if you get rid of Mitch McConnell, there's 50 little Mitch McConnells lined up right behind him. So you have to get rid of the majority Republican Party in the Senate. That is the only way that even if we get a Democratic president, that anything changes.
Right.
So if Joe Biden is what it takes to do that, if that's what, if Biden Harris is what motivates black women, black men, middle-aged white men to go to the polls and vote, I don't care. Like, Biden for president, fucking hoorah. Like, whatever. Get that asshole out of there. And I think that's what the majority of people feel.
Let's say.
And we can talk about, like, cultures and what's important to us later. Like, we can discuss that down the road. Get this asshole out.
Wait, so are you telling me that right now, or can I tell my hypothetical?
No, please.
Okay, so like, say hypothetical. Let's just say everybody votes for Elizabeth Warren. She gets in. She picks a running mate. Do you think Elizabeth Warren has the fucking stamina, the people behind her to win against Trump? I like how it's like us asking Jackie these questions, like she's like political guru, because she is. She fucking is.
I think that if people actually researched what Elizabeth Warren stood for, instead of just listening to the hype that comes out of Fox News and Breitbart, yes, because she is actually pretty moderate on a lot of issues.
I agree 100%.
I don't know if that will. Elizabeth Warren doesn't translate well to middle-aged, college uneducated white men. It's another woman nagging at them, telling them what they need to do. So I don't know. But like I said, I think if they actually took the time to research her, yes, I think she could win. If they just go in there blindly and are like, I don't know, a woman who reminds me a lot of Hillary Clinton, or I haven't really been affected by Trump's presidency yet. Like, cause the average middle-aged white working class male isn't feeling the burn of Trump's presidency. It doesn't matter to him all that much. He hasn't lost his job. Probably. He probably doesn't have a lot of friends that have been affected. His kid, he's still been saving for his kid's college education. None of it really has hit him yet. I don't know. I would like to say yes. I love Elizabeth Warren. I would like to say that yes, they would go in with the same gusto into the voting booth that I would go into. My biggest fear is that if another woman loses, it will be decades until we see a third option for a female candidate.
Which is so sad, because I feel like these women are coming out against this guy that is a guy's guy. You know, like, I used to talk about grabbing pussies in the locker room. No one stopped me. Like, that's what I think propels these men, these white single, or not even single, but these white straight, you know, cis men, like that, to like be aligned with Trump, is like, they just see this, like, this guy's guy.
I don't, it's like, I think it goes deeper than that. I think a lot of it is based around them wanting to provide for their families, and they feel the safest with someone they recognize. I don't think it's actually a hatred thing in most cases. I know it is in some, but I think in most cases that looks familiar, and so they feel comfortable. And because we haven't had a female president, that's scary and uncomfortable. And I think fear is a greater motivating factor than, gay women and can kind of identify fear. Women can identify fear easier than men can. Gay women can right. identify it even easier. And women of color identify it better. And women of color who are on the LGBTQ spectrum identify it even greater. So our like stakes are much higher than the people who actually decide the election. And we can have a conversation about the Electoral College and the validity of it and if it should even be a thing anymore. But until it's not, white working class men are who we have to worry about, or mm-hmm. who we have to convince, because a lot of them have sway over their wives too. So
right.
it's not fair, and I'm not saying it is, and it's not right, and I'm not saying it is, but that is the cards we have right now, and we have to play the cards we have in our hand at the moment. So
well, I think it also speaks right. to our society that a man who is the epitome of toxic masculinity won the presidency of the United States and continues to have so many supporters despite his shameless, flagrant, repeated examples of his toxic masculinity.
Sure.
I mean, that's right. at 3.5 years later, I'm not desensitized to it yet. Sure. Even though it's been in my face for 3.5 years, it's like I look at like middle-aged working and middle-class white men when I see them out, and there's always like a flicker in my head. Is that another Trump supporter?
Mm-hmm.
It's right. weird how I do that. It's weird how I do that sometimes, because, you know, you pick up conversations, especially, you know, if you're writing out in public, you pick up a lot of conversations that you hear.
Sure.
And he's been horrendous. He's been egregious in the things that he has said about women, and people don't care. They just don't care.
So I've been trying to change my thinking about it, because I agree with you, Gene. I fall into this spiral sometimes of people don't care, and how can they not care? And I go down this disgusting, like, do we even matter? Like, are we truly second-class citizens? Have we come that far, you know, since 1920 when we actually got the right to vote? Like, I go down this cycle, but then I look at men that I know in my life. I know Kai, and I know Ben, and I know all these men that truly care about women and care about their success. And like, I look at all these things, and I've kind of landed on, I don't think it's that they care. I think it's because they don't really pay attention, because it doesn't directly affect them.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of and I don't know if apathy is worse or a convenience.
It's dangerous.
It's
just dangerous.
I don't know what it is, because push came to shove, these men in my life would throw themselves in front of a bus for me, you know, would defend me in any situation. Like, all of these things could happen in their immediate lives where they would be 100% on my side, no matter who was saying it. If Trump himself came to this house tonight, I know that the men in my life would do anything to protect me. I know that.
Right. Right.
But that doesn't translate well, because the politics don't affect them, because they're not an at-risk portion of society. And I don't know right. how to make them see that. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to make someone see an injustice when they don't have to live it.
Right. Like, it's hard to tell your, you know, 85, 86, 87-year-old stepfather, who is a white man, who has been, I don't want to say racist, but racist for most of his life, that Trump is a bad guy. You know, like, he's a bad guy, and you're voting for a guy that doesn't really give a fuck about you.
But they haven't felt it.
Yeah, it's hard to tell him that. It's hard to tell my stepdad that. Like, because he hasn't felt it. He hasn't had to go through it. He hasn't seen, like, the fall of the economy. He hasn't felt anything. He doesn't have to have two jobs to pay his bills. He does not have to do any of that, because he's an older, white, straight man.
Yeah, there's not a good answer, because people are complicated, and they're different, and their life experiences make them see the world differently. And like, all I think most people want to do is create a world that is better for their children than the one they had. And I think because of people's experiences, they view the lenses on how to make that happen differently. So like, for me, for an example, I don't want my son to have to grow up in a situation where people are unjustly mean to him or hard on him because he has gay moms. So yep. that was one of the impacts on us moving back to California, because the likelihood of that happening, it's not zero here, but it's greatly reduced, right? But I am aware that that happens. So if a person has never had to face that, how do you tell them you will literally have to move your family to get away from this kind of disrespect or disregard or whatever, because they've never experienced it. So there's these things that you can talk and talk and talk about how they make you feel or how they impact you, but how do you actually translate the actual cause and effect of something to people who have never had to experience it? And the thing I think we're missing in all of this, because we talk about cis white straight males, we expect them to understand something that isn't, they can't. We can't, we will never understand what a trans woman of color feels like. You can empathize with them, but you will never actually know the fear that they experience when they walk into a heteronormative bar. You will never, we will never understand that. So how do we expect cis white straight males to have the same empathy for us when they have never experienced any type of fear? Like, we expect too much when they don't have a lens to view that through. And I think we hate on them too much because they can't understand it because they've never been given anything to see it through. So instead of making them our enemies, I think we have to spend more time on articulating our circumstances and what has happened to us and the things that we have felt and seen, because the majority of these men that care about us would be really hurt and appalled to hear the things that you've gone through.
Right. And my coworker, remember when I had that big, huge discussion with him about how he thought he was being put upon because he's this poor, straight, white guy. And I was like, that has nothing to do with it. It's the fact that, like, you don't understand what I have to go through. I was like, just because I, you know, I'm a woman and like, you think that I'm fine, but you don't understand that, like, I can't walk down the streets of Tampa holding my girlfriend's hand because I'm like, I will get things said to me that you will never have to go through because you're a straight man. And he would never understand that unless I said it to him. And then he said, oh my gosh, like, and then his stepdaughter is a lesbian. So he was like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, she's had to go through, yes, she's fucking probably had to go through that. And if she hasn't, I would be shocked.
But that's the thing. So I don't think they don't want to. I just don't think they have any ground.
No, they haven't. But I think a lot of people have never tried to explain it to people because until this moment, it's never been this dire. We've never been like, we've got to fucking do something or we're all fucked. You know what I mean? Like, now we have people coming to us that have been like, have you really been put upon? Like, we have independent people that have been like, have you really been like made to feel like you don't belong in American? Yes, I have been. Like there have been, I think there are more people like questioning whether or not they are going the right way because of everything that's happening, which is a great thing. But there's so many more people that have been like, this is the right way with Trump. That is scary. It's super scary. But, so we have to make sure that our arguments not only are like convincing, but that they are like emotional enough that people that don't have to go through it can connect to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I also think we have to make an effort to not make these individuals our enemies and say, you just don't get it, but make them our allies. By saying, I know you don't get it and I understand why, and that's okay. I will never understand the plights of people of color. I just won't. I will never experience what they experience. But it's not my fault, just like it's not their fault, but I want to learn. I want to know how to be a better ally. And I think if we approach them differently, instead of saying, fuck you, you don't get it and you'll never understand, if we say, let me show you our world, I think we may have a different outcome. Because I think we're isolating a huge swath of the population that doesn't necessarily deserve... Now, some of them do. Some of them are a bunch of knuckle-dragging morons. But the ones who aren't, we are isolating them because we're making sweeping generalizations. Not we as like us four, no. But like we. Yeah.
You guys gotta be better about this. Come on, you four.
Get it together, you fucking idiots. But we don't. We don't even give them the chance to try and understand it because we're too busy telling them how they don't. And right. that's not fair on our part. And I've tried to come to some self-realization about it.
Do you think, though, that even that wonderful attitude would work in the Bible Belt?
I think with as time goes on and more people come out and I think it will work with some. Will it work with all? No, of course it won't, because some people are just always going to be who they are and change is too scary for them to embrace. But yeah. I think it will work with some, and some is all we need. We don't need all.
Right, right.
We just need some.
Sure.
The rest are just a bunch of bag of dicks and they'll never change.
Well, they'll die off eventually and we won't have to deal with them anymore.
Yeah, I might be dead by then, but I'm holding out hope for the next generation.
You have completely pickled your liver. You're going to be fine.
Aaron, I don't think you get how this works.
Okay, case in point, look at my son. Okay? He is going to be a generation of male that is brought up completely differently than a lot of generations of males. He's going to look at women differently. He's going to treat women differently. But if you were to look at him and just the general passing by, he looks like, well, as far as I know, a white, straight, cisgender male. Would that be fair to place that on him when you don't know that he has two moms? Like all of these things, we don't actually know. We're assuming things based on you guys understand. I don't have to explain anymore. You understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
So I don't know. I think we need to make better work of educating people instead of assuming.
We definitely, I agree with you 100%. Like, we have no idea, like, about some of the younger kids that are being brought up in today's generation. And hopefully,
out at like fucking 12. It's going to be a whole different.
Right.
It's going to be a whole. Like, look at Jean. Her generation came out much later. My generation came out later. And now we're looking at 12-year-olds. Like, it's totally different.
Right. We might have some kids that are like, hey, 3 years old.
And good for you. Like,
I like the vagina, you know, like, whatever it takes.
How's everyone's drinks? Like we did...
Oh, God.
Aaron's good. Jean?
I'm good.
It was good. You know, if it wasn't Sunday night, I'd probably have a second or third or fourth or fifth. But
wait, you only have one?
By Sunday, man. But it was comforting. And it was delicious.
I feel like this whole Sunday night thing's really cutting into our ability to let loose. Not mine, but everybody else's.
Well, Thursday night is when I start hitting it hard. By Sunday, I gotta dry out.
When Jackie moves to a location where she's close to work,
yep.
She can leave work at a reasonable time and not feel bad about it because she's
gotta go back to Thursday.
Yeah,
I could handle a Friday at work hungover a lot better than I could a Monday at work.
This sounds like a conversation we can have later. Okay. Nicole, how's your drink?
It's good. It's nice, especially for a red. I usually can't do that much because it's just so heavy. But this is actually pretty nice and light, easy to drink.
I've been drinking it all, trying to get through you dicks.
Yeah, do you have
it's not
any
you guys. It's just the effect of politics. It just makes you want to drink.
I'm surprised Nicole Disney has left the conversation.
No, I'm like halfway through the bottle.
Nicole's a sipper.
Am I supposed to drink the whole thing? I didn't know.
Many have.
Are you kidding me? I've drank half a bottle of vodka.
No, literally no one is surprised by that. Literally zero people.
Zero people. Maybe zero. One.
No.
Not a single.
We have about 4,000 listeners, and none of them are surprised to hear that.
Let's make it 8. Let's make it 8,000.
Mine was really good. My wife picked well. I would buy it again. It tastes delicious, and I don't feel like too drunk or too sober. So I'm like in that happy spot of being like, oh, yeah, life's good.
Do you know what else she picked good at?
Huh?
Do you know what else she picked good at? You.
Oh, Erin, that was a reverse sackbot. You reverse sackbotted me.
You know what? That's all I'm talking about tonight.
Who knew there was a reverse button on that thing?
You know, I'll get you later, Jean. I'll get you later, girl.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in for our very lengthy conversation.
A double episode.
Double episode. You're welcome.
We'll put it in two parts.
No, we won't. We won't do that because I edit them. So until next time, I am Jackie D, the literary lesbian.
I'm Jean Copeland, the feisty feminist.
I'm Erin Zach, the geeky gal pal.
And I'm Nicole Disney. And that's it.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you, Nicole. We love you.
Love you too.
Thanks, Nicole. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.